Hi, everyone. It's Judy Warner. Welcome back to the On Track podcast. Today, we have my friend and front-end engineering guru, Jerry Partita, who's the Director of Technology at Summit Interconnect. We're going to talk about three IPC roles that you should absolutely know, keep, and then sometimes break. And he'll tell you how to do that and why it's important. So lean in, enjoy. I'll see you on the other side.
Welcome to Altium's On Track podcast, where we talk to leaders about PCB design, tackling subjects ranging from schematic capture all the way to the manufacturing floor. I'm your host, Judy Warner. Please listen in every week and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all your favorite podcast apps. And be sure to check out the show notes at altium.com/podcast, where you can find great resources and multiple ways to connect with us on social media.
Well, hey, Jerry, thanks so much for joining us again here on the On Track podcast.
Thank you, Judy, for having Summit on and sharing what we know from the fabricator's point of view and the data we receive from our customers and helping them to understand what are some of the IPC items to know.
Yeah. So I know you just did a talk at IPC Apex. And whenever I want to know something about design for manufacturing, you're my first call. So let's talk about IPC standards, specifically ones that are critical for design engineer and why knowing them is so important.
So the design guidelines for designers, which are the documents that are like 2221, it's a 2220 series. So 2221, 2222 for rigid, 2223 for rigid flex. And what's being worked on right now is the first time 2228, which is for high speed RF design and digital, is the rules that will help you have a successful build and understanding what is allowed, what classes they are, in order to get a good result on the board build. But there's some time, not every condition is known. And when those conditions come up, it's one of our first topics.
Yeah, so that's when you get Gerbers and then you start calling people back and the job gets delayed.
So about 60 to 70% of designs have a question that comes up that we don't have clarification on what to do. It wasn't stated. And we need to understand what are the expectations on the finished board. And that's when there's actually a term that's used within IPC, and it's a five-letter acronym. It's AABUS, which stands for as agreed upon between user and supplier, where the designer is the user and the fabricator is the supplier. And so when there's conditions that arise that are not clearly defined in 2221 or 2222 or within the performance specs, which are like IPC 6012 or 6013, we need to state an acceptable condition that I, as a supplier, have to meet and what your expectations on the finished board. And so this is called ABUS. So you ever hear somebody goes, hey, we need an ABUS condition, this is what we're talking about. It's not clearly defined, or you've written something that conflicts with the standards and we need a ruling to make sure that we build what your expectations are.
You know, that's something I've heard from other board suppliers in the past, that there are many times that there'll be conflicting callouts in the drawing where what they're asking for actually conflicts with the standard. Is this the kind of situation you're talking about?
Yeah, there's times where that occurs where somebody says, I want a class three board, and then they'll state something that's actually class two. And it's like, well, which one do you want us to follow?
I see.
Do you want us to overrule the class three and follow the class two, or maintain the class three and not the class two? And then even sometimes in a customer spec, they will write both conditions in the spec. It's like, okay, you have both conditions in there. Which one am I supposed to comply to?
Right.
So I have a really good example of an ABUS condition.
And, okay, let's hear it.
And so in the performance spec, IPC 6012, which means what the board has to be finished and meet, there's a section called, in section 3.3.1, called edges. And it states that you can't have any haloing. So when we route the edge of the board, you get fracture in the glass epoxy bond, and you can kind of see like light, like a halo. Like it goes in from the outside into the part. And we have to stay 0.004 of an inch or 4 mils away from any conductor, from the haloing. But there's a separate paragraph that states when the edges is not designed the edge spacing is not designed in accordance with IPC 2222. Evaluations of NICs, crazing, delamination, and haloing shall be ABUS, which means you have to write a condition that I have to meet. Mm-hmm. So, and it says if you didn't design to the design guidelines 2222, then you have to write a condition saying, still you can't have it closer than 4 mils. Or it's like, we know we put the copper too close to the edge of the board. So it's acceptable if the condition is less than 4. You have to state that haloing to the conductor is allowed because it's clearly states that you have to call out an AABUS, an ABUS condition. But it's like, well, people don't know what was I supposed to design to? I don't know the conductor to space to edge. Where is the rule at? Well, it's within 2222, like it says in 6012. This is kind of like reading tax tables. You got to read this book, that book, and then actually it calls out 2221. So 2222 states that the minimum distance of a conductor surface and the edge of a finished printed circuit board shall not be less than the spacing listed in table 6.1 of 2221. So it's already 2222 calls out 2221. And it says,
they're all referring to each other.
Yeah. And you need to know all these books and the relationship to each other. So in 2222, it says the distance is 15.7 mils, but you got to look at table 6.1 that says based on voltage, external layer or inner layer. And then it even breaks it down by what's the elevation? Because if it goes up in space or high altitude, that space has to be even greater.
I see.
And as a fabricator, if we don't know, we don't know if it goes in space or 20,000 feet or 30,000 feet or it's on the ground. And so in this ABUS condition, the designer has to state, I put copper 8 mils away from the edge. Remember, it says 15.7 plus the voltage minimum distance. And so if you go to 2221 on table 6 or on section 6.3.3, there's a bunch of different conditions. That one is if it's an inner layer, one if it's an external layer, one if it's above a higher altitude than another. And so in some cases you add 2 mils to the 15.7, and other conditions you add 4 mils to the 15.7. So basic rule is you have to add 4 to the 15.7. So let's just call it 20 mils. So if you design a board and put copper, a conductor, 8 mils away from the edge of the board for ESD purposes, and you want it so that you don't have noise or energy getting into the board, and you put that copper 8 mils from the edge that I'm building, then you must state an ABUS condition that haloing less than 4 mils is acceptable. And so that's an application of an AABUS, and you have to state it on the drawing. What happens if you don't? If you don't state it, we build the board, we finish the board, somebody inspection looks at it and goes, there's haloing for less than 4 mils from the edge of the board because it's 8 mils away.
Yeah.
Now we have to call the customer and say, will you please accept this product that we built and spent all the time? And if we rebuild it, it's going to be the same condition because you did not design in accordance with 2222, 2221. So if the condition's written on the print, then we know that this is accepted by the customer and we're allowed to let it go. And so that's where AABUS, ABUS conditions stated on the appearance prevents that delay.
Now, Jerry, my perception is maybe a large aerospace company or, you know, large OEMs seem to have a better handle on being really compliant or, I don't know, just having more resources available to think about these specs. What's your experience with that where, you know, maybe it's a smaller design team or a design bureau or a group of two designers? Do you see this more in one scenario than the other? Or like, why is there so much disconnect between specifically between IPC standards and what you end up seeing on your end?
That's a really good question, because most people's when they think about the IPC design guidelines, they go, those things were based 20 years ago. We're not designing anything like that anymore. And those specs that were written a long time ago don't comply to today's standards. Mm. That might've been true when they first came out, But we continuously work on refining the documents, the guidelines, the acceptance to current manufacturability, as well as the complexity of designs that are being built and designed today. Mm-hmm. So they're becoming more and more current that if you follow these design guidelines, they are more current now than they've ever been. Mm. And we continuously revise all of the design guidelines and performance specs about every 2 years. I'm on about 5 or 6 different committees that work on the standards. And by the way, everyone can join for free and help make the product better. The design guidelines, the performance specs, please join. It's free. And by the way, you get all the books that you are part of for free. And you can see what's being flowed down and be part of the conversation of what do we need in our industry to make good, high-tech, reliable products. I highly recommend it. People join it if they have the time. It's free. If you don't show up, no one cares. They're not taking roll that you're there or not. But it does help. The more input, the better these standards become.
Right.
Which leads us into one of the good questions. Like, well, if I don't read the specs, what do I care? Well, you could design stuff and get yourself in trouble.
A lot of trouble.
A lot of trouble. So, for example, you know, a lot of people, if you look at your car dashboard and you look at how the speed, it goes from 0 to 120. The oil can go to, like, let's say 200% what it should. Mm-hmm. The gas is 0 from, you know, to full. The temperature has a temperature from 0 to way over boiling. It says, well, the dial's all there. I can push them all to the limits. No, you can't. You can't do all that and then take a turn at 30 miles an hour turn at full speed.
Yeah.
Just because the dials say you can do it doesn't mean you should be employing them all, because you're going to burn up the engine or you're going to crash.
Right.
And this is a lot of times what happens in designs. Hmm. Well, I can do this. You can, but it's not going to be a high yielding product or a high reliability product, because you put in too many difficult things into the design to be manufacturable or to be reliable in whatever it's supposed to perform in, whether it's space, mission critical, where lives are on the line. You can't push the envelope and expect it to be safe out in the field. You got to consider the reliability in it. So our next subject, I think, the non-functional pads.
Yes. Yeah, so Les, I remember last time I think it was your list of 10 things or the data you actually, I'll share it in the show notes below, the data you give me and what I actually do with it, which is like one of my favorite. And you talked then about removing non-functional pads, right?
So,
dig into that one.
So when we remove non-functional pads, your design's done. That's fine. That's not really what I'm talking about today.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is people said, listen, I have to route a lot of conductors on this inner layer. Mm-hmm. And if I have all the pads in as I'm routing, the auto router has a harder time calculating the minimum distance and trying to get tracks between vias.
Yep.
So if I remove all the non-functional pads and then turn the auto router on, it'll get done much faster. But the rule within IPC guidelines is you leave the pads, you route the conductors, and then you remove them afterwards.
Oh, interesting.
It's an actual rule, and I'll read it to you. Internal land should not be removed to make enough room, and it's in quotes, to make enough room to route a circuit between holes to help maintain internal minimum spacing. Circuit routing should always be performed with all the lands in place on all the layers for each hole. After all the circuits have been routed, non-functional pads may be removed.
Huh.
Now, nobody knows. A lot of people don't know there's a rule for that. There is a rule.
Why is that rule there?
Because we have a pad.
Yeah.
We have a drill in it.
Yeah.
Whether the pad's there or not, our drill wander, our layer movement is still the same.
I see.
The distance between a drill that's done at a different time and a conductor that's imaged and laminated at a different time, they're two different zeros.
They're independent
of each other. And if you have a pad and a 5 millimeter ring and allowing tangency, what you've signed up for is that drill can be in any direction 5 mils.
I see.
And so that 5 mils belongs to me. And then,
so it's giving you, it's almost like giving you a safety net, you
it's
know,
a safety
over,
distance.
Safety
it's a
distance,
and,
yeah.
and between the, if there's a pad and a trace, you have a minimum distance so it doesn't short.
Mm-hmm.
Good. We still need that same distance if the drill's right at that, at the tangency of that. That distance is still required. And so the rule is that space plus the minimum space required for worst case condition, you have to add per that table 6-1 and 22-21, 2 mils. Now here's a couple of other things that reduce it. You do etch back and remove material, it's even closer. And if you got wicking that can go 2 mils, that's even closer. You have to add back etch back, wicking, the worst direction a drill can go. And when you add all that stuff up, they probably shouldn't be under 8. Just for the record, I build boards with 5 1/4 drill to copper for certain types of design, but not mission critical. Not
right.
when lives are on the line, not for 3 or 4 lamination cycles. You can do it on the first lam cycle, but when you do multiple ones, you can't do a drill to copper 5 1/4. You're going to get a short and it's going to fail in the field. Mm-hmm. So most people don't, and I see this all the time in designs. They'll go in there, remove the non-functional pads and route the traces. You can tell because you see a trace shade the drilled location and stays away from a pad. And it's like, we're going to have bad yields. And there's sometimes we just go, nope, you got to redesign this. Why? Because you have 50,000 holes that have drilled a copper at 7 because you removed the non-functional pads and routed your traces. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same spacing. No. The space between a 2 conductors, if the layer shifts, conductors move together. Between a pad and a conductor, on that layer, they move together. A drill and a layer are independent of each other,
yep.
and they're done at 2 different times. And you've got to take those into consideration. Many designs that I've seen have had to go back and redesign it because the yields are pushing really bad, low yields, and they're low reliability because they removed the non-functional pads, routed the traces, and put the drills in. And
interesting. That's not what I thought you were going to talk about.
So this is like, this is
why I call you, Jerry, when I want to know stuff.
And that's for a via. So if you tell us a 10 mil drill, we drill with a 10 mil drill.
Right.
You have a component hole that you want an 18 mil finished hole. We don't drill 18. If it's Enig finish, we're drilling 22. Mm-hmm. So you've lost 2 more additional annular rings from your design for us to finish at your hole size. So we drill bigger to finish at the right hole size.
Right.
And so typically for an immersion finish, we drill 4 over your stated finish hole size. If it's hassle or tin lead reflow, it's 5 or 6 over your finish hole size. And so you lose real estate. It's like an extra 2 mils are lost in the spacing. And so when you remove those non-functional pads around them, it's even worse. And and so usually what happens at point, I goes, what does it say that? It goes right here, section 10.1.3. You're supposed to route, then remove the non-functional pads. And so, yeah, it's a common, and especially folks that do, they do contracting for running the designs.
Yeah.
The more designs they do, the more money they make. To speed up the design process, remove the non-functional pads, route them, done quickly. And then the end user who paid for the contract for the design ends up having a board fabricator saying, I got low yields, you need to go back and redesign it because you removed the non-functional pads and routed the traces too close. And it's kind of a shocker for some of you. I know, it's like, that's my real estate. And I oftentimes feel like I want to be Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. Stay off of my lawn. Because that space belongs to us, the fabricators, so that we can produce the yields
right
for your design.
Well, that's an interesting one. Okay, number 3. Watch for 3.5 mil minimum dielectric rule on IPC 2221. And there's a workaround.
So there's maybe. And so in the performance spec 6012, if you give us a drawing and we build a board and nothing is stated about a minimum dielectric anywhere in the documentation, the rule in effect is the minimum dielectric that we're allowed to deliver on a printed circuit board is 3.5 mils. If we violate 3.5 mils, we are in violation of the 6012 because we went below 3.5. If you don't state any dielectric anywhere, you don't state minimum anywhere, that rule is automatically in effect. If you call out a 3.5 mil dielect, 3.5, then we're allowed to go down to 1 mil. If you say 3, we're allowed to go down to 1 mil. If you say 2, we're allowed to go to 1 mil.
Oh.
But only if you state this dielectric opening is 3.5 or less, then we're allowed to go down to 1 mil. But many designs have a dielectric call out of 4.
Mm-hmm.
We have a tolerance window. When we buy a 4-core, they can ship us a 4-core that's 3.5 to 4.5 thick.
Yeah.
And that is a 4-core. I can't send it back.
Yep.
You ordered a 4-core, it's plus or minus a half a mil.
Yep.
It's yours. Well, that's our tolerance window for the stated minimum dielectric. If unstated, the rule is 3.5. But when we add prepreg to bond cores together,
yep,
that can vary on how it squeezes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you call out a print of a targeted 4 mil dielectric, we as a rule in our company will say, please state on your drawing that a 3 mil minimum dielectric is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I've never stated anything before. I realize that, but we could be 6/10 under 4 mils easily, occasionally, not always, but occasionally on some layer in the stack up, we could violate 3.5. And if it's so, if we violate it, it's non-conforming and it's a rejectable board.
Mm-hmm.
So we ask for our customers to always provide us at least a -1 in the tolerance for a stated dielectric. So if you have a 6 mil dielectric, the 3.5's effect, that's fine. But if you have a 4 mil dielectric, we're going to want you to state that 3 minimum is allowed in your, and you, this is an A-bus condition. You have to state it as agreed upon mm-hmm. between you and us, the supplier, so that we know that we can safely build the boards and be compliant. It's perfectly going to function at 3.3. It's mm-hmm. fine. Or 3. It's fine. But you got to state it because you have to understand that's what you've designed. So if you have a board that's 20 layers and it's 093, chances are the dielectrics are going to be under 4.
Right.
And if you don't state it anywhere in the drawing, technically we're supposed to ask you to put it in the drawing to allow a lower dielectric because you didn't state anything and you got too many layers and too for the thickness of the board. And so there's actually a new caution that's actually been added to 22222 because this condition comes up. And when I bring it up to customers, like, well, no one's ever told me that before. I go, I know, it's kind of new. Specifications of a rigid thin core materials, for example, 4 mils or less, may require special order material to ensure conformance to the minimum dielectric, or alternately, and this is what I'm advocating, a reduction of the minimum dielectric thickness below the default. For mm-hmm. minimum dielectrics below 3.5, IPC allows you to go to 1. So we've had that. I've done that with customers and they're like, no one's ever brought this up before. You never brought it up before. I go, yeah, but you've never been sitting there with a handful, with many dollars worth of boards in a customer's hand saying, I'm going to reject them because you violated 3.5.
Yeah.
And then you explain to them, you targeted 4. I can't do anything but this. So mm-hmm. you're going to have to add a note in there. And we should have told them up front. So that's what we're doing now. When our customers are targeting a dielectric less than 4 or less than, yeah, 3, 4.5,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and they state nothing, we're asking them, please add this note to your drawing or approve the stack up with this minimum dielectric note on the stack up approval. And then we have a record of it.
Well, it seems to me that all these rules, you know, it's about communicating design intent to your fabrication partner or on your drawing that may go through an EMS to your fabrication partner, however that works out, it seems like there's this disconnect. And knowing these things, and you always teach me about them, and I'm like, why, Jerry? I don't understand the dynamic that puts this, you know, which is really introducing pain, which personally I'm against for design engineers. So what's going on here and how do we stop it?
So the IPC is on a big kick for education
mm-hmm.
to make sure people understand the standards and follow them.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said earlier, I think some of the earlier versions of the standard were a little bit out of date with what mm-hmm. we're building.
Yep.
And we're constantly refining them. And sometimes they hold us fabricators, our feet to the fire of like, man, that's really hard to do. You know, this is what they're building. So this is going to be in there. And there's other things that they've done to make it easier for us to manufacture and to make it acceptable. So I think the documents are getting very current to what is needed. And if you're outside those guidelines, you probably want to talk to a manufacturer. It says I shouldn't do this, but I need to do this. I'm like, yeah, that's a lower yield. And if a fabricator's on a game, I go, is this mission critical? Are lives on the line? Or you go, no, this is just this. I'm like, well, if that fails, it's not the end of the world. Or it's a bench tech evaluation. Okay. If it fails, it's just going to fail on a bench tech. It's not going to fail in somebody's where life or in the hands or
right.
operating a car. It's like, okay.
Right.
I can understand the risk and to get the product development cycle down, it's worth doing some risk and building that way because you can cut down the manufacturing circuit board from weeks to days if you take a more aggressive approach, but know the trade-offs. And so I highly recommend everybody look and read 2221, and then if you're rigid, 2222, rigid flex 2223. And in the near future, 2228 for RF and high speed digital. These things will help guide you. And if it's like, I need to build a board that doesn't comply with this, then talk to a manufacturer, a board fabricator and say, I want to be outside of these rules. What are the trade-offs? And we might ask, well, what kind of board are you building? Do you have is it a blind via on a plated layer or a signal layer? And well, it's a signal layer. Could you move it to a plane layer? Because we can manufacture plane layers with super high yields and ease. But if you put a critical impedance layer on a plated layer, we get variation when we plate. We get lower yields on a print and etch or on a signal layer than on a plated layer. So if you just move the drill one layer down, you might get better yields and you get more consistent signal performance. Or we can go, have you considered doing this? This will save you this many steps and time. So I highly recommend, if you don't know these specs, to read them and understand them. You can go through the reading through the specs, probably the 2221. It's kind of long, but it'd be beneficial for the designers to know that one. And then 6012, what the finished results performance has to be. And that could take you could probably bang that out in an evening type thing. And if you don't understand, call somebody to ask them their help. A lot of times why I do these podcasts and working with Judy and some of the stuff I post on my LinkedIn account is to share knowledge for designers to understand why these things are important so that they have successful builds the first time they design them.
Well, to that end, per your recommendation, Jerry, I'm putting a link to the IPC website where design engineers can do a few things. One, go after those specs. You can get involved in standards committees. You can tie into standards education. There's a whole bunch of stuff. So I'm going to put that link in there. I'm also going to put Jerry's link in profile below. And he does pretty consistently put posts and sort of tips and tricks up on LinkedIn. So I recommend you do that. And also Summit Interconnect's website where you can learn more. You know, Summit right now is the fastest growing PCB supplier in North America, which means Jerry sees a lot of jobs and their team and all their locations. So Jerry, thanks so much. Everything you always teach on the podcast is so valuable and we really appreciate your time today.
I am happy to be here. And if I might just add, if you really want to boost your career in this industry, in the electronics industry, get involved with IPC committee. It is going to be the biggest career jump because you know what is acceptable and what is not. And it'll be a benefit to you, your suppliers, and your end users by knowing that it's built to the rules. So enjoy.
Yeah. And I think that's really good advice to end on. And Jerry's a busy guy and he still finds time, which I really appreciate. And what I know about involvement in IPC is you meet the greatest people and you rub shoulders with some really great people. And just that networking and rubbing shoulders with people that are really, really good at this stuff. You, like you said, it'll really put your career in another lane. So thanks so much to our listeners for joining us today. We look forward to being with you next time. Make sure you go look at the show notes and always remember to like, subscribe, you know, all the usual stuff, because we want to make sure we keep delivering content that's relevant to you. So thanks for joining us today. We'll see you next week. Until then, stay healthy, stay safe, and always remember to stay on track.